Welcome to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. Now, this is a day when we're celebrating as a nation Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So we're going to focus on one of the top issues MLK championed before his death, the plight of poor people in America. And we have in studio with us now Stanford Professor Claiborne Carson, editor of the King Papers and author of Martin's Dream, My Journey and the Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. He joins us as well to talk about King's legacy and the poor people's campaign then and now. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I guess I wouldn't be the first to tell you that it's easy to find people who lionize Dr. King, who idolize Dr. King. It's much harder to find people who are willing to go out and march for the kinds of things he was calling people to go out and march for.
Sometimes I think that if he had lived for his 90th birthday, which we're commemorating now, there wouldn't be a Martin Luther King holiday because he would be too controversial. I can easily imagine him on his 90th birthday reminding us that we haven't really dealt with the issue that he put foremost in his mind during the period 1967, 1968, and particularly with the Poor People's Campaign.
Refresh people's memory. What was the Poor People's Campaign?
Well, it was his idea of, I guess the best way I would describe it in modern terms, it was an Occupy movement. It was a very ambitious one to occupy the National Mall until the nation, and particularly the Congress, began dealing seriously with the issue of poverty. And I think that he was perhaps more concerned about that than he was civil rights. I remember one of the letters that he wrote to Coretta when they were courting, and he described his agenda, and he thought of ending war, global brotherhood that transcended race or color, but also dealing with the maldistribution of wealth in the world. And I think those were the key issues. I think in some ways describing him as a civil rights leader is a misunderstanding of him. I think he became a civil rights leader almost accidentally because he happened to be in the same place that Rosa Parks was in 1955. But he was basically a social gospel minister. And like other ministers from that similar background, he was quite concerned about the plight of poor people. I think he would have been very disturbed that seems to be an issue that has kind of dropped out of our political discussions. None of the debates, presidential debates, even mentioned poverty. And it's hard to even remember that 50 years ago it was the national policy to eliminate poverty. And now I think it would be hard to find a serious political leader who or a leader that would be taken seriously, who would call for an end of poverty.
I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that Dr. King visited the San Francisco Bay Area quite a number of times in the last 2-3 years of his life. And we have a cut here from a lecture that he gave at Stanford in 1967 entitled The Other America.
In this other America, millions of people find themselves walking the streets in search for jobs that do not exist. In this other America, millions of people are forced to live in dilapidated, substandard housing conditions where they do not have wall-to-wall carpet, where they all too often have wall-to-wall rats and roaches.
I don't know about the carpet, but what he's talking about, millions of people living in poverty, that seems very real today, and not just, nationally speaking, but in California specifically.
And even in Silicon Valley, which is probably the richest place on Earth at the moment, and, people cannot afford to still live there, and many people are leaving because they can't afford it. So I think that we need to maybe redefine the notion of poverty. We have perhaps a stereotype But it, I guess one definition I would have is if you're one missed paycheck away from poverty, you're poor. And a lot of us are in that position. So I think that we need to begin to realize that these issues are related to many other issues, the issue of health care, the issue of education. Health care is getting more expensive, and a lot of people don't have insurance, even under Obamacare, which is itself endangered. And also, I think that all of us are really threatened with, you know, one serious illness. We're poor, you know, and that can be a middle-class person facing unexpected medical bills. So I would hope that this is an issue that we can bring back to the nation's attention. And then I think if Martin Luther King were here, I'm certain that he would be doing that.
You know, you mentioned earlier that we don't hear a lot of politicians talking about poverty, but we do hear social justice, religious leaders talking about poverty. We hear labor leaders talking about poverty. And there is, as it happens, a new poor people's campaign that's just come about in the last few years. Can you talk about that?
Well, Reverend William Barber, as you know, spoke at Stanford last Thursday.
I know who he is, but tell us who he is.
Well, I think he's one of the ministers who are really in the King tradition. He's trying to arouse the nation's conscience. He believes that this is a moral issue that people of faith should be paying attention to. And he became prominent in North Carolina for leading voting rights campaign. But I think now it's broadened, and I think he still wants to broaden it further, in particular to prepare for the next election so that we won't go through another election cycle in which the issue of poverty gets almost completely ignored.
He spoke at Stanford last Thursday night before a capacity crowd at Stanford's Memorial Church. And one of the things I was taken with that he said, he was chastising the progressives or the liberals in the audience saying, let me say, Trump is not America's biggest problem. Oh, I knew you weren't going to clap. That's all right. And then he went on to say Trump is a system, or a symptom, rather. What did he mean by that?
Well, I think we focus too much attention on the partisan political divide. And I think in some ways that has fed Trumpism, you know, that we pay a lot of attention to it. It dominates the news cycle, and it distracts us from many other issues that are really serious concerns, that should be serious concerns of all political parties. And I think that what he's trying to do is to get us off that track where it's really about two parties competing with each other and not really confronting, not really developing a program that deals with the broad issues. You know, when Martin Luther King, in 1967, he wrote a book called Where Do We Go From Here? And he was talking about the time after the passage of major civil rights legislation. And he was saying, what's next on the agenda? And I don't think we've answered his question. I think that we're still trying to confront the problems of the 21st century, and we haven't really identified what they are. And they are serious. They are global. I think in King's time, we tended to think of these issues as something that could be solved in one country.
Although he did talk about colonialism, he talked about the Vietnam War, he talked about the intersectionalities.
I think he did, and I'm not saying that he did. I think that the nation as a whole ignored the part of his message that was meant as a global message, that he understood that we couldn't deal with poverty in one country because, you know, if one country is rich and another country is poor, there's going to be all kinds of problems that are created by that, and we're seeing that in our own time. So we have to begin to confront the interrelationships of, you know, he was concerned about war. Well, war creates refugees. War creates more economic problems. And our military spending is could be used to help solve some of these problems. You know, just a slight cut in the percentage of our budget that goes to the military could solve the problem that many young people face of having to go into debt to get a higher education. You know, I think it's really discouraging when we think that back in my college days, you know, I could go to the UC system for $99 a semester.
Wow.
And when I mention that to young people, they can't even conceive of that because many of them are running up $20,000, $30,000, sometimes more debt to go through college. And so they start out adult life already in debt.
We're talking with Claiborne Carson, director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford University. I want to encourage you to join in this conversation because we do just have a half hour. So take this moment now to dial us, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. We're on Facebook and Twitter. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. You mentioned earlier Reverend William Barber, and it's heartening to see somebody who is a younger man, if not a young man, certainly younger than many of the leaders from the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s who are passing on now, sad to say. Let's listen to a cut from Reverend Barber the other night.
We've already seen our leaders assassinated, but instead of killing the dream, I declare the dreamer lives on, because nothing, absolutely nothing, would be more tragic than for us to turn back now. It's movement time.
So you're hearing there, you know, one of his key points, which is, you know, don't worship King, you know, pick up the baton and keep running.
One of the courses I'm teaching, right? Well, the course I'm teaching at the moment is called From Civil Rights to Human Rights. And what I try to do is just say that we're in a new era now, that looking back at the civil rights era, where it was basically a concern about equal citizenship rights, getting rid of all the bigotry and involved in second-class citizenship. And in the 21st century, I think that the main concern has to be human rights, because that is something that is meant to cross national borders. And ultimately, that gulf between our citizenship right and our human right, I think, has gone more pronounced over the last 50 years. You know, most people don't really give a great deal of attention to the notion of human rights. You know, what are our rights that we take with us wherever we are in the world, wherever we cross borders? And I think it's because now, with the passage of civil rights legislation, we feel more secure in our civil rights. So as long as we as Americans feel okay in terms of our basic rights, we don't really care a great deal about this notion of human rights. And I think that for many people in the world, that, you know, they have to be concerned about that. Because citizenship rights in many parts of the world are not worth very much anymore. I went to Zambia to celebrate their 50th anniversary of independence, and they were, you know, a lot of national pride about, you know, the independence struggle. I met with the surviving independence struggle leaders who became the first government of Zambia. But amidst all of this pride, I also noticed the visa line at the American embassy, and it's probably similar lines at other embassies, and how many people would rapidly give up their citizenship rights, which they had fought for a visa, a work visa, to go someplace else in the world where there's greater opportunities. And I think we have to begin to address that issue.
That people have kind of abandon the larger questions of human rights in favor of economic opportunity?
Well, when we
or that they see them in contradiction to each other.
When we think about our own Declaration of Independence, it was a human rights document. You know, when we talked about all people are endowed with certain rights, and among these are the pursuit of happiness. And economic fulfillment is part of that happiness. And yet, we as a nation have kind of put up walls around that. And just said, okay, if you happen to be an American citizen, you get certain kinds of opportunities. But we don't really care very much about what goes on in the rest of the world. And to the extent that we're responsible for some of the problems in the rest of the world in terms of creating refugees who then need to move elsewhere to find opportunities or to create situations where their own governments are violating their human rights, and they seek asylum elsewhere. You know, all of these problems, we're not separated from those problems. Sometimes we cause, as a nation, those problems. And I think what King is trying to say is that all of that is interrelated.
But now I'm going to push back a little bit. You know, the new Poor People's Campaign is organized around what it calls four evils: systemic racism, poverty, the war economy, and environmental devastation. And then we've got two dozen demands, each linked to one of those themes, but it's a laundry list. And, you know, it makes me worry that, you know, when you have so many demands, you don't have a clear, succinct message. You don't have one concept a lot of people can get behind. And that seems to suggest that it's politically dead from the get-go.
Well, I think that we're at a stage where we have to begin to think of these big issues. Human rights is a big issue. It's not going to get solved in the near term. You know, I think that one of the romantic ideas about the 60s is that, you know, you have Martin Luther King gives a speech, and then we have the next year the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We have a march in Selma to Montgomery. The next, just even a few months later, we get the Voting Rights Act. Most change doesn't happen that way. And that change, that civil rights change, happened at the end of a long, decades-long half century since the founding of the NAACP, a half century since the Niagara Movement. And so we see the culmination of a movement, and we think that that's what movement is about. But the movement was there in 1900 and 1905, 1909, and we might be at that stage in the movements of the 21st century. We might be at the beginning stage.
You're saying plan for the next 100 years.
Well, I think that the people I've always admired in the movement were people like Ella Baker and you know, others who were what I would call the long-distance runners. They had been in the struggle from the 30s to the 40s to the 50s and the 60s and even into the 70s. And they understood that change is a long process. You have a vision for what you want to achieve, just like W.E.B. Du Bois had a vision of civil rights, and he died on the eve of the March on Washington. So he, even though he lived into his 90s, he never saw the culmination of his dream. And that happens. But nonetheless, you begin to have a vision. And I think it has to be a global vision, because I really feel that there's not going to be, you know, these, we try to solve them as individual nations, but we're so interconnected that that's not going to be possible. And therefore, it's going to be a long struggle of educating people about the interconnection of these issues. You talk about the laundry list. It's probably a much longer laundry list that we could come up with. But I think the thing that connects them is this notion of social justice, equality on a global scale, and basic human rights.
Let's head to the phones. Reed in San Francisco.
Hi. I would like to ask the professor about the status of institutes in general, but in particular, the Martin Luther King Institute at Stanford. Is there maybe a mission statement that distinguishes that kind of internal institution from other activities of the university?
All right.
I'm not so sure where that question is going, but I think that I would say that, yeah, we do have a mission statement to carry on King's legacy. And it's not necessarily a political statement in the sense that, you know, we're not a political agency. But our job is to make sure that King's ideas thrive in the 21st century. And that's what we do. For us, every workday is Martin Luther King Day. You know, that's what our job is, to spread those ideas.
Speaking of politics, we just saw Senator Kamala Harris announcing her candidacy for the presidency on MLK Day. She has clearly a mind towards echoing history there.
I'm very pleased to see that the next presidential campaign seems to have a number of people in it who have a broad vision, and we'll see how that works out in terms of the actual how well their campaigns do. Cory Booker was a former student of mine, and we know Kamala Harris I knew her father, and I think that there's a real chance that a new generation of leaders will come to the fore. And some of those have a deep grounding in what King and the movement of the 60s was really about. And they understand that it was an incomplete struggle and that their part of their job is to carry it into a new century.
You know, I'm wondering if you can tell us how poverty today differs from, you know, back in King's day. Like, has it gotten worse? Has it stayed the same?
It never stays the same. I mean, it's, you know, the kind of poverty that King found in Chicago when he went there in 1966 is, in some ways, it's quite familiar. I mean, when we talk about slums and things like that. But I think it's also, now we're talking about entire cities, you know, places like Flint, Michigan, where they're faced with a wide variety of problems. The way in which economic insecurity has kind of replaced that enduring poverty that was concentrated in particular neighborhoods. You know, I see poverty in Palo Alto when I see people living out of trailers. I see poverty in, you know, all you have to do is look at people who are right on the edge of being homeless. And sometimes, you know, cross that, you know, we talk about students. I had a student at Stanford who was homeless. You know, he ran out of his money and that was it. And we had to kind of rescue him. And this kind of insecurity should not be happening for people who are trying their best to improve their lives, really bright young people who, you know, are still know that they've got debt, they've got an uncertain future. Even if they find a decent job, they don't necessarily have a place to live in the Bay Area. So these are problems that redefine what poverty means.
Tricia writes, huge fan of MLK's nonviolent protest and war on poverty. Love Reverend Barber. I'm a white woman. I want to be involved fighting for justice for all, here and abroad. I want suffering to be diminished as much as possible. And then her question is, where can she have an impact? Where can an individual today find a way to have an impact on these questions?
I think there's lots of different ways. I mean, one of the things that I think is a hopeful sign is that we're dealing with a lot of the symptoms, you know, of this economic insecurity that is widespread. You know, some of us, when you are fighting for a broad goal, all you can really do is get a hold of the part of that long-term goal that you can have an impact on. If you're concerned about homelessness, try to deal with that in your community. If you're concerned about the lack of decent health care, you know, there's ways we can take action at the local level. And in California, I think we have a lot of opportunities to do that. We're a rich state. We can set a model for the rest of the nation. The problem right now is I don't think we necessarily set the model when we have places like in Silicon Valley where people are struggling to keep their homes and finding it very difficult to live here. So I think that part of what we can do is just take it at the local level and try to make our community serve as a model for the rest of America.
Nigel writes, people need opportunities, not handouts. But when business people prefer cheap disposable workers like illegal immigrants, the government ought to step in and stop the exploitation. Our society is broken. We still need handouts largely because governments let businesses hire non-Americans instead of Americans at every skill level. So he is talking there about a globalized labor market that does lead to questions of human rights.
I think it does. And I think in some ways we can look at immigrants as the scapegoat for the issue. Clearly, we have, you know, in Silicon Valley, we have a need for skilled labor. Our university, Stanford University, is open to students from around the world. So I think that trying to make it seem as if the problem is foreigners coming in and taking the opportunities away from Americans, we have to realize that we have that benefit from an economy that benefits us all, and that it needs skilled labor.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today about the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Stanford Professor Claiborne Carson, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me, Rachel.
Continue the conversation online, www.kqed.org/forum. I'm Rachel Miro. Thank you for joining us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.